Hey, deserving listeners, it's that time of year again where I get a chance to answer all your emails. I'm trying to do that at the end of the year here, beginning of the year. So let's get to it. This first email is from Abby from Finger Lakes, New York. She sent me an email. She said a number of things in the email, but one of the things that she said was she says she often will carry with her my 10 things that I often will say. And she listed them off. And they were like a bullet-pointed list of things that I frequently will talk about and little notions or advices that I will give out. And when I read this list, it was so weird to see a list of my belief system in a summarized form listed back to me. Because for me, I'm just sort of yammering and talking about all sorts of things, and I've never really sat down and listed the foundation of my approach or how I see things. I mean, I certainly can summarize in an academic, clinical way my theory, if you will, my integrative theory, but that doesn't really encapsulate the themes that I think I often talk about, because when I read this bullet-pointed list, it wasn't really tied to any kind of theory. It was just these things that I often will recommend people think about and will give advice about. And so it got me thinking about, like, what are these things that I'm frequently talking about? Because if I just thought about things that I try to push and you know, talk about, it probably wouldn't align with the actual things that I yammer about most often, you know? It's sort of like when I'm, you know, people will watch videos of mine and they will say, you know, you should have a merch. You should have a t-shirt that says this thing that you frequently say. And suddenly I realize, oh, I say that phrase a lot. I didn't even notice that, right? So it was sort of like that. So I asked Abby if she could provide a more elaborate list, because the first list she sent was kind of brief. And so she sent an more elaborate list. And so I actually took that list and kind of rearranged it into some themes. And so I thought I would go over that and let's see if this sort of pans out. And maybe y'all could think about for yourself what you think of as sort of the foundation of different advices that you might give other people, that kind of. Okay. So the first category that Abby pointed out was what I would call relational traumas and schemas. So things related to past relationships, often our childhood relationships, and how that negative experiences growing up will cause us to develop defenses and schemas. And she, you know, I'm sort of paraphrasing what she wrote here, but there are a lot of sub bullet points to this area. And of course that makes sense, because that I am often talking about, it's very core to the way I see the world. Whenever anything happens with a friend or my wife or myself or my family or anything, or even in the news, if there's a politician, I always, the first thought I have is, like, you know, like with Putin, for example, I just wonder what sort of childhood he went through that caused him to develop this distorted way of seeing the world that causes so much destruction, you know? And I don't know, obviously, and I can't know. But anyway, so the sub bullet points here are: abuse and neglect at an early age causes people to develop internal beliefs about themselves and the world, and the world that are distorted. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, difficulties growing up, early age, cause people to develop belief systems about themselves and the world, and these beliefs are often distorted. They see the self and the world through a distorted lens. People have schemas that distort how they see and understand the world. Yeah. Often they are not even aware that what they believe doesn't make sense to others. Nobody wakes up and decides they are going to try to ruin someone's day. Yeah, so when she wrote that one, I was like, yeah, I do say that a lot. I often will say a phrase like, well, no one wakes up, or very few people wake up in the morning and decide that they're going to ruin their life or they're going to ruin their marriage. It's not something that they do on purpose. They're responsible for their behavior, of course, but their distortions, their schemas result in them taking action or interpreting things in such a way that actually it does destroy their life or their marriage or other people, but that's not what they're intending on doing. You know, sometimes people behave badly or dramatically because that is how they learned to get attention when they were very young. They would rather get bad attention than no attention at all. yeah, that's certainly not my idea, but it's something that I sometimes will talk about in the reaction videos that I make. Another bullet point here, overfunctioner, underfunctioner relationships. Underfunctioners believe that they are not capable of actually being competent and making decisions, so they rely on the overfunctioner even more. Yeah, so if you don't watch my reaction videos, you probably don't hear me talking about overfunctioner, underfunctioner very often, but in the reaction videos, it doesn't come up a lot, but it comes up more because in these relationships, I think reality TV tends to enjoy casting overfunction or underfunction relationships because they know that it plays well to the audience, causes an emotional reaction in the audience. Traumas don't have to be what we traditionally think of trauma, like an accident or a death. They can be small things that build over time, like criticism. Yeah. Triggers are not always obvious, like fireworks with a combat veteran. They can be reminders of events. Yeah. So, you know, triggers to essentially this bullet point here, you know, triggers to trauma can be subtle things like just someone asking you to do a favor for them can actually trigger a trauma for you. Yeah. People criticize or say hurtful things or put someone down because they are insecure about an aspect of themselves. They may feel threatened or uncomfortable around you and they want to get rid of that feeling. Sometimes if they make you feel bad, they feel better. Yeah. So again, on these reality TV shows, there's a lot of people being critical or being hurtful or doing hurtful things. And it's confusing. You're just like, why would you do that to the person you love? And the common narrative online and in society is that these people are psychopaths, sociopaths, as they'll call them, or, you know, malignant narcissists. And certainly that can be the case. I can't know with these individuals, but that's not usually the case. Usually it's because they are distorted, they're hurt, they are insecure, they, you know, they're doing everything they can to try to figure out a way to feel a little bit better about themselves. And so, you know, they'll resort to a lot of different things to get there. Okay, so those are all sub bullet points in the larger bullet point that I'm often talking about that I titled Relational Traumas and Schemas. The next bullet point is the short one, and it says, make sure to say to people, I'm sorry you went through that. How did that make you feel? And Abby says that this one has changed my life, exclamation point. Yeah, so I don't know if I'm, I think Abby might be a person who watches my videos because I feel like there's a different sort of yammerings that I will frequently say in the reaction videos that I make as opposed to the podcast, but somewhere along the line, yeah, I am frequently talking about things that you can say to people when they're going through a difficult situation. They're grieving or they are having a medical issue or something. And there's this compulsion or this cultural notion that you're supposed to say a certain thing or you're just supposed to avoid it altogether or something. And the or you're supposed to fix it, for example. And, you know, this isn't my idea, but I'm frequently talking about it, that just attend to them. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly what to say because it's case by case. But, you know, a common thing you might be able to say is just say, hey, you know, oh, my God, I'm so sorry you went through that. How do you feel right now? How are you doing? It's not complicated. And if you do it sincerely, then it'll be often received very well, as opposed to avoiding or trying to fix or making it about you or getting anxious or trying to push a silver lining on the other person. Another thing that I will do myself sometimes or recommend is to just tell someone, oh my God, I don't know what to say to that. I want to help, but of course that's stupid. I don't, you know, what you're going through. I don't know what to say. I'm so sorry that you went through that. You know, just be real. And, but the key is you don't want to act like it's not a big deal. You don't want to act like it can be solved with a simple problem. You don't want to mansplain to someone. You know, you want to be there for them, make them, what would you want to hear in a situation like that, that kind of thing. All right, the next bullet point has a lot of sub-bullet points, and this I titled the conflict area. You know, I'm frequently talking about conflict, how it arises, how to manage it. Some bullet points here. Share how something made you feel instead of getting angry or upset. It gives the other person an opening to understand and have a constructive dialogue. Just chiming in here. Yeah, again, I think this is more a reaction video thing that I'm frequently yammering about, but is instead of transforming your hurt into, or your fear into anger and hostility or rejection or withdrawing, stick with the core feeling, stick with the fear, stick with the hurt. You know, your partner, your romantic partner, your spouse is cold and distant recently and is seemingly giving you the cold shoulder. You don't really know why, or maybe you know why. And there's an impulse often for us in a situation like that to pull away as well, to be like, well, if you're not going to talk to me, I'm not going to talk to you. And that's a passive aggression. It's hostile. It's giving the silent treatment. Or to go to them and say, I can't believe that you're treating me like shit lately, that kind of thing. Or you're such a heartless person or something. Or to go to your friends and say, like, you know, my partner is a complete asshole, that kind of stuff. There's a lot of other things. Or you go to your partner and say, like, you have a problem. Like, I, you know, let me help you with your problem that you withdraw so often, that kind of thing. Instead of, and all those things are secondary, tertiary reactions to the core initial response, emotional response, which is hurt feelings of being rejected and fear of losing the relationship, fear of rejection, fear, hurt of current rejection and fear of further rejection down the line. So it's pain, hurt, fear, anxiety. And if you just go to your partner and you communicate those feelings in a non-accusatory, non-hostile manner, then it gives your partner a chance to rise to the occasion, as I often will say. But your partner may or may not rise to the occasion. It doesn't guarantee it, of course, but it's much more likely, especially if you do this habitually, because the first few, because what I'll get with when I work with clients on this, they'll go to their partner, say it's individual therapy, they go to their partner and they speak about primary emotions and they say, you know, the other day you hurt my feelings and, you know, I'm not angry at you. It just kind of hurt my feelings. The first couple times you do that with your partner, it's possible that your partner will not hear what you're actually saying, because usually when you bring up things like this, it turns into a fight. And so the things you're saying, even though you're saying it in a non-hostile, non-aggressive, non-accusatory manner, they interpret it as such because you've never done it otherwise. And so it takes a while to break the habit, the routine of the fight. And so you got to stick with it, is the point. Because, you know, clients will come back to me and say, you know, I talked about my primary emotions with my partner and they still didn't respond well. They still, like, rejected me and this sort of thing. And, you know, this is why couple therapy is so much more effective in a situation like this, because I can actually engineer the conversation and I can be there for it, because there's no guarantee that my client goes home and actually does what I'm recommending. Yeah, so when we stick to those primary emotions of fear and hurt, and we do so in a non-accusatory way, it can solve so many problems. You know, even among nations, you know, if going back to Putin, and I've talked about this before, but I'm guessing that Putin is afraid of invasion or afraid of being irrelevant or afraid of his supposed enemies. And that is the analysis, that he is invading Ukraine because he doesn't want NATO to be at his doorstep. Russia, USSR often had a buffer. They, over history, over millennia, over centuries, because their country is so large, they, when they were invaded and harmed during World War II by Germany primarily, they relied on land to give them a buffer between the enemy and themselves, so they could retreat. They could give up Moscow if they needed to. They could give up whole swaths of land, but as long as they had a buffer zone, they could always rebuild and fight back and survive. And when NATO and Putin sees NATO as a threat, instead of coming to NATO and the Western world and say, it scares me that you're doing this, and I lie awake at night worrying that you're going to invade or you're going to impose your military might on me. And, we're not the superpower that we used to be, and I'm afraid that you're going to harm us because of things we've done in the past or our ideological differences or something. And so I'm just afraid. And then if Putin were to be able to say that, which I believe to be the primary emotion, the Western world hopefully would rise to the occasion and say, oh my God, I'm so sorry that you're feeling that way. That's not our intention. Maybe there's another arrangement that we could work out. Maybe we don't need NATO per se. Maybe we just all work together, or you could be a member of NATO, Russia. If you just follow these guidelines of human rights and other kinds of agreements and treaties, maybe, you know, we can all be friends. We can all, there's no reason why we have to be at odds with each other. We don't inherently want to eliminate you. NATO would say the only reason why we have NATO and the only reason why we expand NATO is because we're afraid of people like you because of things you've done in the past. So if you're saying you're afraid and we're afraid, how about we just work together as a team? Okay. Just imagine, people out there, if nations could do that. Throughout history, going back, thousands of years, how many innocent lives would be saved because of that? And it sounds absurd, right? But it's not. It's humanly possible for the leader of a militaristic nation to have self-awareness and to care about the lives of their own country, people, their citizens, because, thousands of Russians have died and will continue to die because of this. Presumably, Putin and his government, care about that. Hopefully, I don't know. And so it sounds absurd, but it doesn't have to be. And I'm sure that has happened before. I'm sure that, I don't have an example that comes to mind, but I'm sure that there have been nations that have been more mature and been more aware and been more constructive with regarding this notion that we're more often talking about in marriages. To talk about our fears first, to talk about our hurts first, to trust the other to rise to the occasion, and also to help other, going between NATO and Russia, one of the things that we could have done differently, I don't know all the ins and outs of this, of course, because there's back channel communication anyway, and I'm not a scholar on this, but NATO could have, as they were expanding to Ukraine and other places, they could have gone to Putin and said, look, by the way, we're expanding, but this isn't a threat to you. We don't actually, if this worries you, let's talk, because we're not here to scare you. This isn't some provocation. We don't have larger machinations of taking you over. That's not our mission here. We're just kind of worried about things going back to the way things were during the Cold War or World War II. There's just a lot of anxiety. So let's talk. And maybe there's a deal that we could strike so that you don't have, maybe Ukraine doesn't become part of NATO. But you also don't do the following things, like, give Crimea back and stop making threats about Ukraine. We can compromise here because we don't want Ukraine per se. We just don't want war. We don't want people to invade other countries because it's scary. There's just a lot of bad things that happen from that. So along those lines, in your marriage, you could go to your partner and just say, like, hey, if you ever want to tell me how I've hurt your feelings or how I'm scaring you or making you feel rejected, please tell me because I care and I'm open to that. And you can trust me to rise to the occasion. You don't have to veil those things or stuff those things or transform those things into anger or something, Anyway, so getting back to Abby's list, obviously you've heard me yammer about that. So, that's one of the things. Other sub bullet points here. Most emotional and behavioral problems come down to pain and fear. Yeah, there we go. Avoid talking in absolute terms and accept that you may be wrong. Be flexible and humble in order to cool down a difficult conversation. Triangulation is, Abby actually said triangulation, exclamation point. Again, I probably talk about this more often in the reaction videos, but that how anxiety moves through the system and how a third party will be sucked in and they'll volunteer, that kind of bullet points. If someone needs to leave during a tense discussion, it is because of their fight or flight response. Demanding that they stay in the conversation will only make the situation will only make the situation worse. Never prevent someone from leaving. That is abusive. Yeah. So I'm positive that this is talked about way more in the reaction videos, but not often, but sometimes in the reaction videos, there'll be a conflict and things will be escalating and one person will want to get away for whatever reason. They're just like, I'm done with this conversation, and they'll walk away. And the other partner will sometimes prevent them from leaving or grab their arm or something. And I'll always stop the video and say, no, 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 no. If someone wants to leave the conversation and you stop them, that's imprisonment. It could be considered criminal. At the very least, it will potentially escalate. I mean, putting hands on in a situation like that, because, if I'm in a, huge fight with my wife, which would be horrible, and I don't know if this ever happened, but if I were to be, and I was just like, well, let's reverse it for emphasis on gender. My wife's like, okay, I'm done. I'm out of here. And she's like wanting to walk out the door, and I stand in her way. Well, and she's really fight or flighting in this moment. She has every right to push me out of the way. She has every right to be like, get out of my fucking way or I'm going to push you. And then if I don't move, she has every right to push me. I'm not recommending that, of course, but if you bar someone's exit, not okay. There are very rare circumstances where that would be considered okay. Like if they pick up your child and are about to throw the child out the window, obviously you can bar their exit. But if they're just wanting to walk out of the room or get in their car and drive away or hang up on you or disconnect from you somehow, like you have no right to stop them from doing that. You can absolutely ask them not to. Now, there's a very minor asterisk to this, which is that if you ever do want to leave a conversation like this, if you want things to go well in your relationship, it's best to tell the person, look, I just need a break for 5 minutes or an hour or whatever, and we'll come back and talk. Because often the person who leaves is more on the avoidant side of things, and the person who is not leaving is more on the preoccupied thing. So if the avoidant person is always leaving, it can really trigger the preoccupied person and really cause them to downward spiral. So if you're an avoidant person and you tend to leave in conflict, tell your partner that you're willing to talk about it later, you think, maybe even tomorrow or something. Because if you tell them that, the preoccupied person is more likely to relax a little bit. The best thing you can say, if you can muster it, is if you're leaving, is to be like, hey, so I want to take a break from this conversation. I want to have it. I want to continue this conversation, but for my own sake, because I'm starting to, lose control of myself or something. I just want to cool down for a second. Maybe it'll be a half an hour, maybe a couple hours, but I love you and I don't want to leave you. Because I don't want to leave you, I feel like a break would actually help me be able to talk about this more in the future. So, give me 30 minutes to just walk around the block or something, and then we can talk about it again. Is that okay? So if you say something like that, that will give the preoccupied person or your partner the best chance of being able to calmly, quote unquote, allow you to separate in that situation. It's really hard to do that because often the avoidant person, when they're fleeing, are having massive amounts of stress and high intensity emotions. So it's hard to differentiate and say those things. But if you can manage anything close to that, that's the recommendation. But yeah, so that's one of the points that I often will bring up. Other bullet points: reaching out and touching your partner or loved one during a tense time can calm the situation. Yeah, I will, again, in the videos, will often see that. When I see it, I'll comment on it because very few people will do this, even on these reality TV shows. And it's such a wonderful, when I see that on my couch with the couples that I work with, the families that I work with, where they're in a tense situation and they reach out to each other physically. They hold hands or hand on shoulder, or they sit close to each other, shoulder to shoulder. And this kind of behavior can really mitigate a lot of the bad feelings and the conflict. We're biological creatures, obviously. And when we do this, it changes our biologies. When we have warm, nurturing contact with the people we love, even in the midst of conflict, it can change everything, you know, our blood pressure, our cortisol, our oxytocin, and these sorts of things are protective factors to having the relation, you know, the conflict go off the rails. And the last bullet point here, instead of getting frustrated with someone with negative internal beliefs, give genuine compliments, encourage them, and frequently point out their good qualities. Ask them to talk about things they are proud of. Yeah. All right. So let's take a break. When we get back, I will continue with the bullet point list. All right. We're back from the break. Okay. So I recorded a whole segment here talking about various different things. And later in the day, it was bothering me. So I'm going to erase it and record this. Basically, in this section that I'm recording over, I was asking y'all if, you know, if you're not a patron or you're not currently a patron now, maybe you were in the past and you wanted to become one, that, you know, I encourage you to do so by going to patreon.com. And I went on this long, sort of off the cuff, spontaneous discussion of my anxieties regarding the business model of this podcast and the finances and stuff. And I was totally meandering and yammering and going in circles. And so I thought I would, and then at the very end, I sort of came to this summary. So I thought I would just erase the whole thing and just say the summary, which is this, that one, everything's fine financially. There's not a problem. Two, a good portion of the business model of this podcast depends on patrons, on people signing up to become patrons. And every month there's an attrition. There's people who will cancel their membership on Patreon, which is fine. And there's usually in the past 8 or 7 years that I've been on Patreon, there's at least as many people signing up. So at least we're breaking even every month. And so I can sort of plan for the future based on that kind of thing. And over the past couple of years, you know, I've been growing the podcast and doing more things and hiring people and paying the co-hosts and whatnot and investing in better equipment and video stuff and blah, blah, blah. And so I, you know, have been feeling fine and everything's fine. But in the past 6 months, there has been, you know, I won't go into detail, but, you know, there's been a decline in terms of the patron situation. And at first, I wondered if it actually had to do with the trial, because that was a pretty controversial time for the podcast. But upon talking to people who canceled their membership, because there's a survey that goes out to everyone who cancels their membership on Patreon, and I've also talked with some people. And of course, you know, there's a wide variety of reasons as to why someone would cancel. And of course, I can't necessarily guarantee that everyone would tell me the truth. But generally speaking, the, you know, 99% of people are just like, well, one, I'm not listening to the podcast as much anymore. And two, I just can't afford it. You know, I'm paying for Netflix and I'm paying for all these other things. And I just can't, I just can't pay for these things all the time. And so, you know, it's just normal stuff and a big reason as to why I cancel memberships or subscriptions. So it all just seemed normal. The other thing I think possibly is the reason is that the economy isn't as good, that there's a lot of worries about the future and inflation and gas prices going up and all this kind of stuff. And I think that that is also normal. And I'm old enough to remember when we had this huge economic crash in 2008, and I was a self-employed person back then too, and noticed how my business was really struggling during that time. But, you know, there's always a bounce back, and there was in 2009. My business not only recovered, but did really well, you know, my private practice. Anyway, so the conclusion after meandering for a while is that everything's fine, number one. Two, the main thing that I wondered about is that if any of you are like, well, yeah, I'll become a patron, but he seems to have enough patrons that he doesn't need any more, so why would I become a patron? I'm here to tell you that that's not true. I'm not like kicking back and going like, oh my God, everything's fine. Like every month it's you know, I obsess on certain things and I look at various different statistics to make, because, you know, I'm self-employed. I, you know, and my family depends on me. And, you know, Stacy doesn't really work that much anymore. And she works a lot for the podcast. So, you know, my entire kind of family situation is dependent on, you know, and that's my fault. You know, you could say, well, Kirk, you should have done that. And okay, well, fine. And maybe you're right. But But I don't know. I want to do this all the time. I want to do podcasting and YouTube stuff all the time, full time, and I have been. And so anyway, point is that if you were thinking about becoming a patron and you're like, I'm not because he already has enough patrons, I want to dispel you of that myth. that's just not the case. But returning back to number one, everything's fine. Like legit, everything's fine. If things continue on the current sort of trend, which, you know, I would guess it won't. But again, everything's fine. Don't, you know, don't worry and don't, you know, and some of you care a lot about me and you don't want me to suffer. And so I don't want to inject anxiety into your life. There's zero to worry about. Stacy isn't worried. I'm the only one that worries because I just am kind of like that. And so that's all I have to say. And believe it or not, this yammering was shorter and more concise than the previous time I recorded it. All right, so stopping recording and sort of picking up where I left off earlier. So this next bullet point is the word pathological. So Abby was saying that pathological optimist. Oh, so I will often use the term pathological to refer to people when they have a problem that hurts themselves or hurts others. So you can be a pathological optimist, for example, as Abby points out. I will sometimes talk about that because one's optimism is actually causing issues. You know, they're imposing optimism, and as a result, it causes people to feel like they're not being heard. You know, like you're telling your partner, well, like me, I tell my wife that I'm worried about the patron count. And every time I say it, she's always like, well, things will work out. Everything will be fine. This sort of optimism, this, you know, incessant pathological optimism. My wife isn't like this, but if she were, it will make me feel discounted. It'll make me feel like, how do you know that? And two, that's not what I want to hear right now. What I want to hear right now is that you care and that you understand how I feel, that my feelings are valid. You can certainly, you know, say, like, my wife could say something like, yeah, I mean, I could see that you'd be scared about that. Is there anything that we can do to change that? Or, you know, do you want to talk about it? And then after we do that, she might say, you know, tell you the truth, I'm not personally worried because of the following reasons. I think that things will work out in the end because they usually do, but, you know, I don't want to discount your feelings right now. You know, there's a way of expressing optimism because I feel like a lot of times when people are optimistic, they're scared themselves and they're trying to alleviate that fear in themselves and in their partners, their you know, the other, by just forcing optimism down the other person's throat, you know? And so there's a more delicate way, more diplomatic way, a more caring way to take care of someone with one's optimism, with one's optimistic perspective, you know? All right, the next bullet point sort of category is abuse, the topic of abuse. And Abby writes here, it's okay to empathize with people who act badly because of trauma, but it doesn't mean you have to put up with their bad behavior. Yeah, so I learned this a long time ago. No, well, kind of not a long time ago, but kind of a few years ago that, you know, for me, when I'm talking about abusive behavior, people who commit abusive behavior, I'm not always, but I'll often try to figure out what was the pathway for that individual to become abusive, to commit that abusive behavior. And sometimes the person is a psychopath and what we might call quote unquote evil, meaning that they intend or get off on harming other people. And it's, you know, there's really no other reason besides that. But most people who are abusive are doing so, in my view, because of their own traumas that they've been through and the defenses they had to develop when they were young. Doesn't excuse it, but it explains it. And often I would just sort of end the analysis there, the conceptualization there, because I didn't know that people, upon hearing me say that, they would interpret that to mean that because one might have a compassionate, more accurate conceptualization of their abusive partner, they thus have to put up with the abuse. You know what I mean? I don't know if you can hear a plane going overhead. I have the windows open because it's so warm in Seattle right now. It's really weird. It was like super cold. Now it's like super warm. I mean, not super warm, but warmer. Anyway, so people would say to me, well, okay, you've helped me to understand my abusive partner better, but what if I don't want to stay in the relationship? And I'll say like, well, those things are not connected. Just in fact, they might even help you to leave someone, right? Now that you've given me a compassionate view of my partner, it would be mean of me and I would be re-abusing my partner by leaving them because that would give them more reason to have this abusive defense, right? And thus I have to stay in this abusive relationship. And then I would say, no. It does not mean that. They're completely disconnected things. I mean, they could be related, I suppose. Like if I were in a relationship with an abusive person and I was convinced or was able to see them in a way that provided some compassion towards the abusive person, you know, I'm just like, well, I get why he's abusive to me because when he was young, he was abused and da-da-da. And I guess that could help me to stay in the relationship so that I might go to him and say like, look, I know you're not meaning to be abusive of me, but you are. And I think it's because of your abusive history in your childhood. And so maybe you could get some help for that. And I'll give you some time to do that. But if you don't stop being abusive, I'm going to leave you, you know, something like that, maybe. But what I will say to people when they bring this up is for me personally, once I can see the abuse for what it is and conceptualize it as I often do in a more compassionate way, the end result for me is I am motivated to leave that person. Unless I can predict with high probability that this individual will change soon, like they are very aware of their abusive behavior, they're getting help for it, they've apologized to me up and down, da da da, which almost never happens, by the way. If I heard that, then maybe I would stay with them, but maybe not. So the vast majority of the time when I have identified an abusive person in my life, often with help from my own therapist, and then I have a compassionate view, I will go on a campaign to leave that person, whether it means that I cut them off right away or I go on a slow campaign of gray rocking myself away from that person. Life is too short and I'm not going to put up with that shit and I don't deserve to be abused and I don't care why they're abusive. I just know that they're abusing me and that's bullshit and I'm not going to take it anymore. And if I leave them and it causes them to have more reason to be abusive in the future, that is not my fucking fault. And I am not everyone's savior and I'm not everyone's therapist. That's not my responsibility and fuck that shit. I'm out. All right, let's take a break. We get back. Let's read some more of these bullet points. Actually, let's make the rest of it for patrons only. So the rest of this episode will just be for patrons. And I'm just going to finish the list. I think I'm about halfway through the list. It's kind of interesting. Again, super interesting to go over this list by Abby, to have her reflect back to me these frequent things that I say, you know. And when I read these bullet points, I'm like, yeah, you know, and another thing. So obviously I'm passionate about each one of these things. All right. So if you want to hear the rest of the episode, become a patron by going to patreon.com. But only if you want to. Do not feel pressured. Please, please. But only if you want to. But if you want to, you know, and you want to, then please. All right. Welcome to the Patron Zone patrons. By the way, I am working on some deep dives. This next year, I want to figure out a situation where I'm working a lot less so I can work more on deep dives. Because I feel like there's, and I've talked about this before, you know, all this sort of activities that I do for the podcast and YouTube channel, it's just never ending. And I love it. But what ends up happening is I never have enough time to sort of luxuriate in a deep dive process. The deep dive process takes me weeks of concentrated 16-hour days where I read and write and think and talk and da da da. So I want that back. God damn it! I'm gonna do it this year. That's my New Year's resolution. But first, let's do an OPP, old patron praise, for those patrons that became patrons all the way back in July of 2020. We have RN from Bothell, up to your patron RN. We have Adam from Lafayette, Louisiana. Amy from God knows where. Aline from California. Esther from Budapest. Robin from Great Britain. We have Nell from Pittsburgh. Anthony from God knows where. Upper tier patron Anna from Slovenia. Karen from Michigan, Ava from God knows where, Josephine from God knows where, Kalise from Oklahoma City, Anna from God knows where, Ruzkowski from Pueblo, California, or Colorado, Angela from California, Fairfield, Paige from Georgia, Nicole from Atlanta, Laura from New York City, Teresa from Deutschland, Sarah from God knows where, Lisa from Philly, and Jill from God knows where. Thank you for being a patron and staying a patron through thick and thin. All right, continuing with the abuse category. A lot of times abuse doesn't look like what we traditionally think of abuse. Subtle things like guilt tripping, making people question themselves, being discouraging, giving people the cold shoulder, consistent criticism, talking down to someone, pointing out their faults, etc. Depending on the frequency and degree, any of these could be very damaging to another person, especially children. Yeah, it's interesting that that idea is kind of novel to people, but of course it is because we don't talk about it very much. Abuse usually doesn't start immediately and tends to gradually get worse over time, especially if two people keep unknowingly triggering the other person's trauma. Yeah, most abusers aren't trying to hurt the other. They are actually trying to keep that attachment, and because of their traumas, they don't know how to express their fear or affection. Yeah, absolutely. It's not always the case, but it's a frequent case. And once I figured that out, it just all made sense to me. There's so many things about psychology and personality that were along these lines were kind of aha moments where I, like, one of the first of moments like this was when I finally really figured out why people suffered from borderline personality. And it wasn't emphasized to me, I don't think, enough, or even said to me at all. I don't know. But once I figured out that people with borderline have schemas and traumas regarding abandonment and betrayal, and it leads to them being triggered and assuming that betrayal and abandonment is happening, and then they get very hurt, and then they feel very angry about that and will go on the attack. It all made sense to me, because the way that borderline is often talked about and was talked about back then, they almost framed it like it was some sort of schizophrenic disease where the person was kind of just, without a better phrase, they were just kind of crazy. They were just irrational people suffering from like some sort of delusional problem, and we're just prone to these emotional outbursts as if they were like bipolar or they were schizophrenic or something. And because there are people who unfortunately do suffer from these, you know, disorders, bipolar, schizophrenia, some of those people who suffer from those disorders will have seemingly just completely disconnected outbursts of anger and hostility and emotionality, and it won't have any rhyme or reason to it. It won't really be related to anything that's happening in their life. And I remember that's how people with borderline and really all personality disorders were framed to me. And then when I actually started to treat them and really get into it, particularly with one early client of mine that suffered from pretty classic borderline, and she had a very classic transference experience with me, and I just spent a lot of time listening to her and trying to figure out what's going on. And then all of a sudden it just clicked, and I was like, I get it now. I understand. I see the pathway. I see the flowchart, you know, and thus I understand how to treat this. I know what to do now. Because before it was like, well, what do you know, it was a lot of the recommendations were basically like, you have to, one of the recommendations was you should never work with people like this because they're crazy and they're going to sue you. And there's no point in helping. A lot of people to this day say that about people with borderline, which I find to just be one of the dumbest things. You know, it'd be like if there's a form of cancer in the biological world that is complicated, but there is a known evidence-based treatment for. If in the medical community you had people saying like, well, there's no use treating that type of cancer because it's untreatable, and then, you know, other physicians are like, there is a treatment for it. You know, so you're telling me that when someone comes into your office with this kind of cancer, you just turn them away or you just get rid of them? Like, why are you doing that? That there's an evidence-based treatment to that cancer. Why are you doing that? And that's what's happening in my field and has always been happening. I just find it to be absurd. People will criticize my field sometimes. And sometimes, you know, most of the time I'm just like, well, take it easy. I mean, we're not all a bunch of charlatans. But sometimes I'm like, well, sometimes these people are right, you know? It's sort of depressing, actually. Like, whenever I'm watching or reacting to, like, a depiction of therapy, you know, like, one of the depictions I remember reacting to was the depiction of a therapist on Big Little Lies. What was that show called? there's a therapist that was talking with Nicole Kidman's character and saying, I can't remember the exact thing the therapist was saying, but the therapist was basically saying, you're being abused and you need to leave your husband. And if you don't leave your husband, there's something wrong with you, that kind of thing. And when I'm reacting to it, I'm like, that is terrible therapy. That is, and that's very common that in depictions on movies and TV that they will have a therapist that is very bad as a therapist. And the primary reason for writers to write a therapist into a script is because they want someone to chastise one of their characters from a place of authority. And so they just write in a therapist and they don't consider whether or not a therapist would even say such a thing. And so I was criticizing the therapy and saying, like, that's ridiculous. For a therapist to just basically chastise and shame a client into, you know, because they don't leave their partner is abusive, in my view, depending on the situation. But so I was criticizing it as just yet another example of a bad, poorly written depiction of a therapist in media. But then I also said, but, you know, some therapists will say stuff like this. It's not terribly uncommon to run into a therapist that will say even worse things than this. And so it's embarrassing, you know, anyway. But so getting back to the bullet point. So that's probably some other bullet point that I often yammer about, how I'm upset that other therapists in my field, you know, the way that they approach this sort of thing. Anyway, so another big bullet point here aside. So that's the abuse thing. And then the next big category is don't lie. Again, this is probably something I'm saying much more often in the reaction videos, but it's so often that people will just lie and shoot themselves in the foot. And then so often that people will even recommend other people lie or that they'll support other people in their lies. You know, and it's case by case basis, but, you know, like an example would be, on Love is Blind, if you watch that show, sort of prominent couple in the season 3 was Zeynep and Cole. And it was understood that Cole wasn't that attracted to Zeynep. And she, at some point, asked him to rate her on a scale from 1 to 10. And there were a lot of people saying, in reaction to that, that Cole, he should just lie. He should be, even though he sees her as a 9 out of 10, he should lie and say she's a 10 out of 10. And you'll hear, and there was this other commentator that was like, look, if, you know, look, men out there, if your woman ever asks you to say anything, you know, just lie. Just make sure you lie because that's the best thing to do. That's the nice thing to do. And yeah, maybe for some people that's what they want to hear. They just want to hear that, right? That affirmation. You know, it's just this general approach, this general recommendation that when in doubt, always lie. And I find that to be an unfortunate cultural element that's been happening lately. So you'll often hear me kind of yammer about that. It's like our kindergarten teachers taught us not to lie. You know, were you not there that day in kindergarten when your kindergarten teacher, it's a fundamental aspect of human life and civilization and trust. And like with the rating thing, and I yammered about this for a long time, but in general, like, you know, what do we mean by rating someone, right? If you're to rate your partner on a scale from 1 to 10, based on the common understanding of that, it's like, okay, well, if I didn't know you and I just put you in a lineup, what number would I assign to you or what rank would I put to you? You know, that's different than what really matters, which is how badly I want to be with you, right? how attracted I am to you. That has something to do with your general attractiveness to society, but it's not a major factor, right? And there's individual taste. Some people, you know, they're sometimes people be like, well, that actor, he's obviously a 10 out of 10 if you think about the general conventional understanding of attractiveness, but I'm not attracted to him because I don't like that kind of, you know, attraction is very particular and so should you just lie to someone? You know, you could just say, look, to me, you're a 10. But if I didn't know you, I guess, and I thought about the conventions of attractiveness, I guess I'd put you at a 5. I don't know. But that's not what matters to me, that, you know, that I don't look at you and see you through the eyes of convention or through the eyes of someone that doesn't know you. I see you as a person that I love and I feel safe with and I like and I'm attracted to and I want to be with, and there's really no one else in the world except for you, you know? And so, you know, you're an 11 out of 10 and everyone else is a 0 to me because, you know, I want to be with you. That's the point. So yeah, so I'm often saying, you know, don't lie, stop lying. And the other thing that will happen in these reality TV shows is at some point someone will have lied enough that their partner loses complete trust. And so when the frequent liar is even telling the truth, they're not trusted because they've cried wolf too many times, right? And so I'll often say, like, well, you reap what you sow, pal. You've lied a number of times up until this point, and now you're expecting your partner to believe you and trust you, but, you know, she would be stupid to trust you because you've shown that you lie when it's convenient to you. Trust is something that you slowly build over time with someone. It's not just something that you just have first. For example, when I meet a stranger off the street, I don't trust that person at all. I trust them to be a regular human being, as most people are, but I don't trust them with more deeper insecurities of mine, or I know I can't necessarily depend on that person. I might be able to, but I don't know enough information. That kind of deep trust where I can trust that someone has my back, where I can trust that someone will tell me the hard truth, where I can trust that someone will take care of me and consider my feelings. That kind of trust is something that is built very slowly over years of a relationship. And that will be instantly dismantled with a single lie. Every time one lies, to some extent, you know, the counter goes back to zero. I mean, not completely, depending, but, you know, it's sort of like we've had 300 days since our last accident, in the warehouse. And every time you have an accident in the warehouse, the number goes down to zero, right? Well, every time you betray and lie, the person gets reset. And that's the rational thing to do. You would be stupid to trust someone not to lie who has proven that they lie. Right? This is why it's so important to find a way not to lie. This doesn't mean that you have to tell the truth all the time. You could just decline the question. You could just say something like, look, I can't answer that question because I don't feel comfortable, or it's too sensitive to me, or something. You know, there's a lot of different things you can do aside from just straight up lying to someone or revealing something that you don't want to reveal yet. You know, there's just a lot of other options. And I just find there's so much discourse from people in popular culture and, you know, frankly, among some therapists who will just be like, yeah, just lie, because it's the easy answer. And I just don't agree. And And I think what it results in, because this is all part of my yammering, is that it creates a culture where people are lying more and more and more and more and more. And it's just expected, right? Think about all the various different lies. If you just looked at it through through the lens of, is this truth or is it lies? How many people are really telling the truth on social media about themselves? How many people are really telling the truth? How many politicians are really telling the truth? Most people know through experience that on Instagram, an influencer or a politician, these people are almost never telling the truth, and we just take it. We're just like, well, you know, that's how you get ahead in politics. You can't tell the truth. Oh yeah, well, you know, if you're trying to be an influencer, you can't tell the truth. Or that person's on reality TV, you can't tell the truth, and it just becomes completely normalized. to live in a culture where it's just normal to deceive. It's completely just par for the course. That is dangerous on so many levels, right? That Facebook, for example, the CEO could just lie to the public and say, like, we're not selling your information. That's not happening. It just, you know, commentators would be like, well, of course they're going to lie because that's what happens. Of course, Johnny Depp is going to lie on the stand because, you know, he has to lie. It just becomes, what if that wasn't the case? What if we didn't live in a society where it was normalized to lie? Do you think it would be a better place? I do. I think this world would be a much better place if most of us followed the principle that telling the truth in most situations is a healthier option in so many other ways, right? Yeah. So yeah, obviously that's one of the things that I hammer about. Don't lie. Another bullet point here is true psychopaths or sociopaths are rare. Yeah. I've already yammered about that. And I'm often yammering about that because people assume that any sign of psychopathy indicates they are a psychopath. And I'm, you know, frequently saying, well, it might be that, but it's more likely psychopathic behavior as a result of some other personality problem, not actual psychopathy, because psychopaths are actually a pretty rare individual on the planet. They exist, but they're rare. Another bullet point here. People unknowingly mirror behavior they saw in their childhood. Yeah, so I'm often talking about that in the reaction videos. Another bullet point here, emotions, and some bullet points under the emotions category. Everyone has emotions. It just varies how people express, internalize, or react to them. People who seem blank learned early in life that it wasn't safe to express themselves. Yeah, so there's a bunch of bullet points around being healthy. It's healthy to cry. You want to validate each other's feelings. You know, emotions are very important to pay attention to. And again, not to be disheartening, but in our culture, it's not always the case that people will have that point of view that emotions are normal and okay. And again, even some therapists will have this shaming aspect around emotions or will not emphasize them enough. And, you know, yeah, so I don't have to go over that again, but another bullet point here is avoid idealizing your partner. Huh, what's this one? Especially at the beginning. Oh, right. So I don't know if I yammer about this a lot, but according to Abby, I did enough that, and again, it's more related to these reaction videos because on these reality TV shows, a lot of people are meeting each other for the first time and falling in love and are overly optimistic, perhaps introducing their partner, their new partner to their kids or getting engaged really quickly without knowing the fact that they might be idealizing this person due to new relationship energy. And, you know, you just have to take time before making any rash decision. And then the last point here is go to a therapist. Everyone benefits from seeing a therapist. Stable, loving, encouraging, corrective relationships can help someone with relational traumas immensely. They can learn to trust, be vulnerable, and realign their worldview. Yeah, well, I'm really glad, Abby, that you picked up on that one, going to a therapist, because, yeah. And I'm so encouraged by younger people today, and even Gen Xers and older, the propensity in the last even just couple years for people to go to therapy is so much higher anecdotally to me. You know, like on these reality TV shows like Love is Blind, I feel like half the cast members are in therapy and were in therapy even prior to going on the show. And that was not the case before in my anecdotal experience. So I'm just so glad. Now, there's a shortage of therapists, though. There was already. And so if you want to become a therapist, if you're thinking about that, I'm pretty sure there is a pretty lucrative, successful career ahead of you because of the demand is so high. And listen to all my episodes on that topic by going to the website and clicking on the, I think it's titled, the subject is like for novice clinicians. There's a lot of information about, you know, how to know if you should be a therapist and what sort of graduate school you should go to, that kind of thing. But anyway, so that was interesting. Thank you to Abby from New York for submitting this list. If you have your own thoughts of your own bullet points that you might think about for yourself or for me, if there are additional kind of themes to the yammerings that I have, I'd be interested. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, 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 really do.